Time now is 15:35. We have Senator Green, Senator McGuire, Senator Stevens, Huggins, Stedman, and my good friend from Kenai, Tom Wagner. Senator?
Oh, got her.
Today, we have one, two, three bills. We will start out with Senate Bill 253, which is the Board of Game, and Ms. Jody Simpson will be the presenter. Put yourself on the record, and we are prepared.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Simpson, staff to Senator Huggins. Before you today, you have Senate Bill 253. It's a very simple bill. It basically changes the expiration dates for the Board of Game to be commensurate with those for the Board of Fish. Current law has a different starting date for the terms of the members appointed to the Board of Fisheries than those appointed to the Board of Game. The statute change will prevent problems that arise from the short time frame for newly appointed members to prepare for the large regulatory board meetings that occur near the beginning of March every year, reduce confusion among the public over which board members to contact on issues, and bring the terms in line with those of the state's Board of Fisheries. You should have in your packet a letter signed by the chairman of the board, Mr. Cliff Judkins, requesting the changes, and Mr. Jim Marcotte, the director of Board Services Division, is here to speak to the bill and answer any questions that you have.
Okay, questions or comments to Ms. Simpson? Okay, thank you, Jody. Is Cliff online? Cliff Judkins is not online, Jim, so you got to do it. You ready?
Okay.
Come forward, please. Put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Senators and Chair. My name is Jim Marcotte. I'm the Director of the Board Support Section. And also here we have Christy Tibbles, the Executive Director of the Board of Game, if there are other questions as well. The Department of Fish and Game is in support of Senate Bill 253. As Jody mentioned quite well, it's a very simple adjustment, basically a technical adjustment. It gets the expiration dates of the Board of Game terms synchronized with the expiration dates of the Board of Fishery terms. Right now, with that real short time frame that we have between when appointments are made, which is typically along about February, the early part of the legislative session, and the major Board of Game meeting, which comes up typically in early March, that short time frame causes several administrative problems. It's results in uncertainty for members, existing members, whether or not they'll be reappointed, whether or not they have to do their homework for the March meeting or not. It provides very little time to prepare for the March meeting for new appointees that are tapped and have to show up often in a matter of just days to unplug from their day-to-day commitments to set aside up to 2 weeks to fly to where the meeting is and all. So that's an awkward aspect of that short time frame. On the Board of Fisheries side, they switched over in 1996, and it's worked rather well. One of the side effects of that is that, a positive side effect is that on the Board of Fisheries side, the appointments are made, there's plenty of time for legislative review, and then the board members are seated starting July 1, and then they're ready for the meeting cycle coming up through the fall, winter, and spring. Gives us plenty of time to work with them to arrange new member orientation, coordinate with Department of Law staff and all. And then right now on the Board of Game side, with the appointments being made prior to the full legislative confirmation process, board members are sitting there. They're not confirmed. To some extent, they may be looking over their shoulders about how certain actions will play out politically, and it's generally thought that it's a better board process to have fully seated board members without that unconfirmed status as they take action on things at the March meeting. So in conclusion, this is a fairly minor, simple change, primarily administrative in nature, and it recognizes the important role that the Board of Game has. In that packet, I also included chart depicting a transition period that would allow current members to stay on that, the expiration dates of March 1, but any new appointees, if this bill were passed, would be subject to that new date of expiring on June 30th. I've also included in there the language of the current statute, current Board of Game member list, a summary of the board's two-year cycle. The Board of Game deals with different geographic areas of the state on a rotating two-year cycle. And then I included a list of the historic meeting dates and a historical list of the board members as well. So with that, I conclude, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about this bill. Thank you.
Questions or comments from Mr. Marcotte? Why did it take us 12 years to recognize the practice of the first board? You said 1996, right?
Correct.
Why did it take us 12 years to figure out that that was a better way to do it?
Mr. Chairman, we've had discussions about this problem for a couple of years now, and we've talked about submitting a bill, an administrative bill, and this one's come up through your sponsorship. So it's just a matter of getting around to focusing on this issue. It's
okay. And would you just talk us through again, for those that there's an unexpired term and someone's appointed, could you just talk us through that deliberately, how that works? Someone's appointed to an unexpired term?
Correct. If a member leaves for health reasons or some other reason, and that member is replaced, the replacement person would continue only for the duration of the original term, so that the expiration dates of the terms stay intact.
Or failure to be confirmed.
Correct. And that has indeed happened in the past.
Yeah. Is that a change?
No, it is not.
No change. Okay. Other questions? Or who opposes this?
I can't think of any opposition to this, Mr. Chairman.
And this is your brainchild?
Well, in collaborating with Christy Tibbles and the Board of Game and others in the department. Okay. Yes, we've.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It makes perfectly good sense to me. Does the fact that many members attend a meeting in March without confirmation, what problems have you seen caused because of that? Has that been a problem? I can see some problems in being an unconfirmed member, and politically, you're trying to make a decision at the same time, hoping that you're not going to make so many enemies you never get the job. Can you just sort of comment on specific instances?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stevens, I think there's a twofold problem. One is there's a general public perception that members just been appointed, they haven't been confirmed, so they don't have the full support of two branches of the government. And so, to some extent, it's a public perception thing, but it undermines their status as an acting board member. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is that if they act on proposals in March and then they have their confirmation come up after that, right, then there's undue scrutiny on very specific details, maybe a single vote, and that has happened here recently. Whereas it might be more appropriate to look at a member's overall ability to serve as a board member and not just focus on a single issue that the member made in good faith at the time.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Other questions or comments? Is there anyone online to speak? Mr. Judkins is not online. Okay. Anyone else in the room to speak to this bill? Okay. Any final comments, Mr. Marquardt?
No.
Thank you. The will of the committee?
I just have one suggestion, Mr. Chair. I thought that this is such a simple little bill. What if we just rolled Senate Bill 176 into this, and then we could expedite the two of them?
That's why this bill hasn't been introduced before. Thank you.
Okay, will the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion that we move Senate Bill 253, Version A, from committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal.
Is there objection? Okay, seeing none, 253 is moved from committee, and we'll take a brief leave. Gabrielle, you ready?
I am.
If you would put yourself on the record, we'd be proud to hear from you. This is our second hearing of this bill, as I recall.
It is, Chairman Huggins. Chairman Huggins and members of the Senate Resources Committee, I'm pleased to be here to again introduce House Bill 165, which relates to providing field accommodations for big game hunters. As you mentioned, we did hear this bill towards the end of the session last year. I understand that it was held because you wanted to have both the Department of Law and the Department of Public Safety give them an opportunity to weigh in on this bill. We have notified both the law and public safety that this was coming up for a hearing today. We heard back from law that there were that they did not believe that there were that the bill raises any issues for the Department of Law, and we've not heard anything back from public safety. So I assume that no news is good news.
Okay, good, good. Would you give us a refresher quickly?
Sure. Back in 1996, there was legislation which was passed to define who is a big game hunter, outfitter, or transporter, and to provide regulations for licensing and other considerations. However, there was no provision for the person who merely wants to rent his or her cabin to people who may or may not be hunting. There are many people in rural Alaska who have extra cabins or whose cabins are empty for part of the year, and what this bill will simply do is allow them to rent their cabins without falling into any of the regulations found in the 1996 statute. And it's real difficult for people in the rural areas to generate economic development, and this is just one way that they'll be able to do so. And members of the Big Game Commercial Services Board have worked with our office in order to craft a bill that will protect their interests while allowing others to do business.
How did we discover this was a problem?
I discovered that it was a problem when I received an email from one of my constituents.
Okay, to talk us through that.
I think I'm going to let my aide, Suzanne Hancock, do that because she's the one who's actually been working with the technicalities of the bill and with that constituent.
Welcome, Suzanne. Put yourself on the record, please.
Suzanne Hancock, staff to Representative Ledoux. And I believe the gentleman that first brought this to our attention may be online today to testify. And there's been some other folks that have weighed in on this and other outdoor groups that have also felt badly that there were individuals that were trying to just rent out their cabins and not be present on the scene or provide any accommodations or field camps or act as an outfitter or a guide. And they thought that these folks should be allowed to simply just rent out their cabins.
So let's simplify it for a moment. Senator Stevens owns a cabin on Kodiak, and he wants to rent it to a hunter that's going to chase the famous Kodiak brown bear. He can't do that presently?
Presently, he cannot.
Well, I apologize to you. I can't believe we're so bureaucratic. I mean, shame on us. I mean, seriously, shame on us. And this bill will correct that.
It will.
And who opposes this?
As far as I know, nobody opposes it. Am I correct, Suzanne?
The only people that we heard from that were had an issue with it were people that had cabins on leased land, because this only takes care of cabins on private land and also state and federal cabins on state and federal land. And it doesn't take care of people that have cabins on leased property. And the only thing that you know, the one individual we heard from wanted was for us to expand the bill to include people with property with facilities on leased property, and the main reason that we didn't go that route is because we had worked with several groups such as the Big Game Commercial Services Board, and they were kind of nervous. I mean, some of the things that happened in the 80s that led about to have this law was people that were saying that they were outfitters when they really weren't, and sometimes this did involve leased property, so we just didn't want to muddy up a simple situation by, you know, maybe making it more complicated.
Senator Wagner?
I don't know. Maybe I didn't follow everything, but the question you just asked Senator Stevens, how to qualify that. This person renting out these cabins, though, is a transporter or a guide. Am I correct?
No.
Okay,
that's...
So if I have a business license and my business is renting cabins or my business is renting hotel rooms, what law that we have on the books now prevents me from renting that hotel room or a cabin to a hunter currently?
Well, Senator Wagner, through the chair, I can look through here and find the specifics, but it might take me a minute.
Well, how is it different than renting a motel room?
Well, actually, the gentleman that who may want to testify and would probably clear this up, Mr. Chairman, didn't think there was anything wrong with him renting his cabin until the trooper showed up and told him that he wasn't.
What's the name of the person?
Rick Metzger.
Rick Metzger. Okay, well, you look that up. We're going to go to Rick.
Okay.
Hey, Rick Charlie Huggins here in Juneau. Can you hear me? Hello, Rick?
Yes, Mr. Huggins, I can hear you.
Yes, would you put yourself on the record and kind of bring us up to speed in your experience with renting cabins?
Okay, Mr. Huggins and board committee members, my name is Rick Metzger. I'm a rural property owner from Kodiak Island. I'm calling in support of House Bill 165. I participated in the process that developed House Bill 165 with Representative Ledoux's office and the Big Game Commercial Services Board. The situation that arose about renting the cabins was I've been renting cabins for several years, and in November of 2006 I was visited by the Kodiak Enforcement Detachment Officer Anderson, and he said that basically because of some new wording implemented in 2006 that removed the word from the definition of field, that I was in violation of the definition of field by renting a cabin in an area not associated with a city, town, or village. So the wording of the definition of field is what we came in conflict with.
And what year was it? Excuse me, Charlie Huggins. What year was that?
It was August 2006 when the legislature reauthorized the statutes for the use of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. They did some apparent housekeeping or house cleaning on the wording of some of the statutes, and they removed the word usually from the definition of field that used to say usually associated with a city, town, or village. They removed that word and just made it associated with a city, town, or village, and that was the impetus that the enforcement troopers used to shut down my cabin rental.
Okay. Questions or comments from Mr. Metzger? Senator Wilkowski?
I'm just trying to figure out where in the statute it makes this illegal, because I'm looking at the definition. There is a section of definitions, and I see it's 808-54-790. Usually associated. It just goes to associated with the city, town, or village. But I'm just trying to figure out where that ties in, saying that you can't rent out your cabin or house.
Well, the definition of field and also... you see, something was, I think, in the outfitting portion of the definition, there was some mention of facilities. I don't have it here in front of me, but it got very confusing and convoluted, but the crux of it was the troopers took the opinion that and I could no longer do it after. I had a business license from the occupational licensing, and I had much correspondence with them stating that it was all right to rent the cabins up until the time the troopers came and interpreted it a different way.
Okay. Senator Wagner?
Sir, are you a transporter?
No, I'm not a transporter or a big game guy. I'm just merely a property owner.
You're a property owner with cabins for rent, right?
Yes.
And they're saying that you can't legally rent these cabins?
Yes, because I am not in an area associated with a city, town, or village.
Rick, I'll apologize to you. I can't believe we live amongst such a group of bureaucrats.
Well, thank you, sir. I hope we can straighten it out. It's really been a burden on my family to have lost that income, and as Gabrielle and Suzanne said, it's very difficult to make a living in some of our rural areas, and this was one fine opportunity for people that lived in desirable hunting areas to make basically a modest income from their property.
Yeah, it appears to me to be splitting hairs, but you're the victim of splitting hairs, it appears. Rick, if you would stand by, we're going to go next to Mr. Jim Peterson.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, Mr. Peterson?
Yeah, this is Jim Peterson.
Yes, would you give us your affiliation, Mr. Peterson, and we'll be prepared to hear your testimony.
Jim Peterson. I'm just representing myself, and I'd like to say that I support this House Bill 165. I live down at Dead Man Bay in the summer. I'm one of the few people that do. I met Rick Metzger when I was in high school, so he's been there for many years. We're both pretty gray now, and that was back in 1965. And the bottom line is he's providing a service that modest income people can go out and rent a cabin and enjoy the beauty and the and what the South End of Kodiak has to offer and not have to hire a guide and go through the great deal of expense like Ted Nugent bear hunt or something, And it brings a lot of joy to a lot of people who come down there and they really enjoy it, and I see nothing wrong with what Rick was doing.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Peterson? Next, let's go to Mr. Robert Fithian.
Yes.
Hello, Mr. Fithian.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Charlie Huggins, how are you doing today?
Real good, Chairman Huggins, members of the Senate Resources Committee. My name is Robert Fithian. I represent the Alaska Professional Hunters Association as their executive director, and I'm testifying from my home in Lower Tomsina, Alaska. The Alaska Professional Hunters Association supports this bill. This is HB 165. It clarifies a much-needed loophole that prevented people like Mr. Metzger from being able to do what was right, and we're glad to be part of supporting the amendments that make it possible to do what's right. That's really the extent of my testimony. I just wanted you to know that we support this bill. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Fithian. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Fithian? Okay, Representative Ledoux, you've seen this letter before?
Yes, that's why I just asked my aide to pass that out.
Yeah, could you walk us through this since you are familiar with it?
I can't walk it through you because she's out making one more copy.
Okay.
And I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
Okay, I think basically what it says is when this new law was passed back in 1996, it changed the definition of field, and it took out the word usually. I'm not really sure that even made any difference, whether it said usually or not. But because of the changes that were made, that was made in the law, I think the Department of Public Safety got a little bit more stringent in enforcing the law. And prior to that change, this gentleman, Mr. Metzger, was allowed to rent those cabins, and then they decided that no, he wasn't going to be allowed to do it. Because under the regulations, whether it's usually or whether it's simply usually associated or whether it's simply associated, this area is outside a city or a township. If he were in a city, for example, if he were in within the city of Akiak, there'd be no problem with him renting out a room. But he's outside of the city limits, and that's where the problem comes.
Yeah, I'm just baffled by all the crime that's out there. Someplace in our state, we discover this crime.
Mr. Chairman, does this cover Mr. Metzger, though? Because doesn't this, on line six, it refers to, with the intent to receive compensation, only accommodations to a big game hunter. Aren't you referring to people who were renting the cabin who were not a big game hunter or who were not even hunting? Or did I misunderstand that?
You're looking at nine.
Section, yeah.
Nine excludes accommodations to a person described in AS 0854-875. So this allows somebody like Mr. Metzger to continue to provide services without being considered an outfitter.
No, I was looking at line six. The provisions of this chapter do not apply to a person providing for compensation or with intent to receive compensations, only accommodations to a big game hunter in the field at. Is that a double negative? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
I think I kind of figured out what's going on here. In 708-54-720, A11, it says it is unlawful for a person without a current registered guide, outfitter, license to knowingly outfit a big game hunt, provide outfitting services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then if you look at definition of outfit in 799, it means to provide for compensation or with the intent to receive compensation services, supplies, or facilities to a big game hunter in the field. We changed the definition of field slightly. We took out the word usually, and I think Representative Ledoux is probably correct. It probably didn't even matter that we had usually in there or not. Mm-hmm. But we, because of that, the troopers then interpreted that to mean that if you're out, if you're in the field, then it is unlawful to do this. So I see how the fix was made. This fixes it, I think.
This fixes it?
I think this fixes the problem by my reading.
Okay, where does it fix the thing for a person who's not hunting?
You're not covered.
It's already okay.
It's already okay.
I thought you said that there was.
It's only for big game
non-hunter. Renting the cabin.
No, it's about hunters.
Yes. Is that right, Representative? It's already okay that the Mr. They can rent these cabins to someone who's not hunting. It's when you're a big game hunter that the problem arises.
That's correct. And if I said something to the contrary, or if you interpret it that way, then what I said was incorrect. Right now, you could go out there as long as you were just taking photographs. But if you went out there with a gun with the intention of shooting something, then it would become a crime.
Yes, Senator.
Just even a casual hunter, not a guide, not an outfitter, not anything else, just a hunter.
That's the way the law is right now, and that's the way the law is being interpreted and enforced right now.
Okay.
You think?
Senator Stedman?
Mr. Chairman, on line nine, number two on the waiver is the state and the federal cabins on state or federal land. What is the current state policy of renting state cabins to a big game hunter?
Would you like, Senator Stedman, through the chair, what we discovered while we were writing this was it was just a kind of a cleanup to put them in, because right now they are renting their cabins, and a lot of times the people are hunters. And another thing that I found interesting is what they consider big game hunters. You could be going out there shooting rabbits or deers. It's not that you're going after elk or moose or bear.
Mr. Chairman, yep. Can we get a finer point on it? Are they renting the cabins to registered guides?
Now, I don't know the answer to that question, sir. I think that, Senator Stedman, through the chair, I believe that I don't know if there's any mechanism for the state to determine if someone who is renting a state or a federal cabin, what they're, you know, if they do, if they are a licensed guide or if they aren't. And there may be someone online that would know the answer to that question.
Paul, come on forward.
Well, the troopers certainly should have been there to check it out.
Yep.
It's that critical.
Paul, pull up a chair. We got three mics. We'll have three chairs.
Thank you very much. My name is Paul Johnson. I have the unfortunate
position. Paul, just one second. Alice, I noticed you didn't come charging forward with your dad. No? Okay.
Getting smaller and smaller.
I have the unfortunate position to be in the chair of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. This goes back, there's a lot of history here. This goes back clear to 1990 when a task force was put together to put on hats on people, transporters and guides. It was chaired by Jan Fakes at the time. I sat on that committee, and it worked through on what was a field and what was a cabin, what was allowed and what wasn't going to be allowed. And what it said was at that time was that through regulation, not through statute, through regulation, that you had to have a transporter license or a big game license, one or the other, if you were going to do these kind of activities. One of the things was that was left out here, I think, beyond anybody thinking about it, was a situation like Mr. Metzger. Also on federal lands and those issues. It's all only big game. It has nothing to do with photography or anything else. It's just if you're licensed or taking people out for big game hunting. So through that whole process, then, we started up the Commercial Services Board. In 1996, the Commercial Services Board was sunsetted. At that time, it was put back into statute. So this stuff ended up being stuck into statute at that time. It wasn't there prior. It was in regulation. So when it got stuck into statute, it went through that process. And when we reauthorized the Commercial Services Board last year, that got stuck into statute. Got left into statute and was not let to go back to regulation. So we couldn't act on it from the Commercial Services Board. Mr. Metzger came to us. We got Kevin Saxby and we got the other board members and said, and what it was not, just so it's clear here, it wasn't that Mr. Metzger couldn't do what he was doing. It wouldn't be that he's illegal. He'd have to get a transporter license if he wanted to do it, and Mr. Metzger felt that it was unnecessary for him to get a transporter license. We felt that was the case also. So the board came and asked Mr. Metzger to follow through with one of our board members, who's also from Kodiak, Dick Rohr, to come to Suzanne and to Representative Ledoux here to assist us in getting the statute changed. So this is a help to us. This is something that we've worked with Suzanne carefully on, came to a compromise of what it was going to be, and I think we've come out to a good solid compromise. Who has to have a transporter license and who doesn't? And this allows Mr. Metzger to go do what he was doing. I think the reason the public safety got involved, very simply, when our board restarted, public safety wasn't paying any attention to any of those rules and regulations from 1996 on. And all of a sudden, when this statute came through, bingo, this one got lifted to the surface. I hope that we can solve it today and move the bill through.
Thanks, Paul. Senator Green?
Yeah, I was just curious your comments on why you haven't included lease lands. And do you agree in that would muddy the water? Because I just don't want us to come back next year and say, lease land, I have a lease property and I have a cabin and I want to rent it.
Yeah. On the original task force in 1990, those issues all came up. Mm-hmm. And as state lease lands and so forth were out there, wherever there was some way for the game industry to burgeon into other areas, it was headed that direction. And the department and everybody else felt, if they're going to be in that business, that they need to have a cap or a hat put on them. And so it would request somebody now that if they have leased land, that they'd be, have a transporter license, $250 transporter license, they'd have to make the annual reports so that everybody can have a feel of what's going on. We felt this was an intrusion upon people in their private lands that they own personally and felt that they shouldn't be included in the process. So yes, it would muddy the waters.
Senator Green?
Okay, so if Mr. Metzger had been on lease land, you wouldn't have had the same interest in this?
If Mr. Metzger was on lease land, obviously it depended if it was a five-year lease, but all of that, all of those things, I think that what it boils down to is the board's personal feeling about private land versus lease land. It really does make a huge difference. You're going to have a lot of different times coming up down the road here on lease land. It will make a complication. Yes, it will.
To have the lease land as part of the provision?
Right, correct. Leaving it on private and federal lands. Federal lands have always had their cabins, as we're all aware, on Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, have got cabins that people use to go. And,
Senator Green?
Where would typically, who would be the owner of the typical plot of lease land?
State. Does that include on a cabin, or, you know, how are you going to define cabin then? Is that going to be a tent, or is that going to be something that's a 60-day lease, or a summer lease, a part-time lease? It makes a lot of difficulties.
So it's okay to have a state cabin leased out to people, but privately owned cabin on state land?
I guess I'm going two different directions here at once. On most state federal cabins, they will not lease those to people who are in commercial services. I, as a guide, cannot go rent a cabin on federal land.
Is there a prohibition?
On the federal side and the state side, yes.
Okay, when you fill out that.
Cannot be used for commercial purposes.
Okay.
Not from our side, from the state DNR side and from the federal Forest Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Okay, so when you fill out your application to go rent the cabin or whatever the process is, you have to give that you are, you just risk being caught?
You risk being caught. My permits are very clear. For instance, my permit is with the U.S. U.S. Forest Service in Southeast Alaska, and it has right in there these cabins. Absolutely. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you.
But just to follow up on that, there are people that have cabins in preserves around a park. Now, what's that land status?
Lands that are, for instance, let's take one we can all refer to as Adiakitat Unit 5 on Dry Bay is on preserved land, and he is a guide, and he has a guide license. Mm-hmm. If he wanted to transport off of that, he'd have to have a transporter license. Gary Gray's his name, he happens to be a guide. So, and yes, there are leased cabins on there, and they're required, since they're a commercial entity, they are required to have a transporter license or be a big game guide, one or the other.
Senator McGuire.
Well, through the chair, I'm trying to think back to the original public policy in 1990, and I think the issue was that there was potential abuse going on the part of big game guides and folks coming in, transporting folks and even guiding without any apparent control and regulation. And so I think what I remember is that we tried to identify two
correct
pathways to which we could oversee that. So then just help me on the final part philosophically between why someone who is leasing out, let's say, a cabin they've had in their family for 50 years on state land, philosophically we would say you have to have a transporter license. However, 7 miles away, Joe Blow, who has had a privately owned cabin, maybe even only 2 years, would not have to have that transporter license.
Philosophically on that, I think it boils down to, in fact, we all have, Senator Wagger's got a good friend, Clark Whitney, who's had a leased piece of state land for many, many years. And state leases with DNR, they vary from 30 days to 60 days to 90 days to 180 days. Is that cabin going to be a tent platform? Mm-hmm. Senator McGuire, through the chair, if you go down to one of the present shows that are going on and look at the advertised activity that's in our state and the advertised situation on big game in our state, we would all fall off our chairs. People trying to work around what our present laws are to try to keep hats on different people. And I think that for the time, the concern here is of people who have private lands, is to allow them to proceed without having to go through our bureaucracy, as Senator Huggins mentioned. I'm embarrassed. I should be embarrassed. It was something that went over the top of my head a long time ago.
Okay, Senator Wagner?
Well, I was just going to say, I happen to have a lease on state property, and a lot of other people around me do, called a duck shack.
Yeah.
And I think we're precluded from certain uses with that lease because it's primarily for a seasonal use. Now, I haven't read the lease in years and years and years, but I think there are some restrictions what we can and can't do on that. And I don't think we could start renting that out for people to go use it for hunting purposes, because there were some commercial fishermen who wanted to start set netting over around our site there, and they wanted to rent that from us, and they were precluded from doing that. So they're pretty restrictive, because first thing the state wants to do, of course, is get rid of all the cabins on the leased property. So when our children die, they'll go in and burn the cabin down.
Mr. Johnson.
That's part of it.
Just one more comment to the committee. I also have a Forest Service cabin. It's down up north of Sitka. It's been in the family for many generations. It will be burned down at my son's death. And so I'm well aware. But in that permit, it is very strict. I cannot use it for commercial purposes at all. So even though I am a guide and can use it for bear hunts, we can't.
Senator McGuire.
Oh, and I just want to say on that point how sad that is. You know, from somebody in my generation, philosophically, I just want to say on the record that is so sad. You know, we only have 1% of all land in our state in private ownership, and so these are our lands. And I just think about the opportunities. I mean, I remember going to the duck shack when I was growing up, and the thought that, you know, my son or my son's son or daughter wouldn't have those same opportunities, I think it's something to reflect on.
Yeah, that was, of course, a federal through ANILCA, that was the process, and that's what we ended up having to live with.
Okay, Senator Green, you have a question?
I can't remember.
Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Can I just get a clarification on who this bill would apply to? If you get a permit and you to go out and get a moose, would this apply to you, or is this for guides only?
It is for people who are in the commercial aspect of big game only.
Only.
Commercial aspect of big game only. Not picture taking, not doing any other thing. Commercial aspect of big game. If you're making money off of big game, we would like to know what's going on. And this is allowing an exception for the commercial aspect of big game.
Can I, Mr. Chair, just follow up? Do you know what percentage of these big game hunts involve Alaskans doing the hunting as opposed to people from outside Alaska doing the hunting?
You mean how many of those who are transporters or of big game guides who are Alaskan residents and are not?
No, people who are actually doing the hunting with big game guides.
You know, that varies throughout the state. I spent a lot of time talking to Mr. Metzger with Rick, and I would say that probably, from what I understand from Rick, over half of his is of residents coming down to take advantage of the permit draw in Kodiak for bear and for deer and so forth. And so I hope I'm not misquoting Rick, but I think that he told me. Now, in other parts of the state, it's 100% non-residents. In Prince of Wales Island, we have a situation that's 100% non-residents. So it really varies throughout the state. There isn't a pat answer.
So, Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to come back to line 9, where it deals with state and federal cabins on state and federal land. If I recall earlier, you'd mentioned that you cannot, as a commercial guide, go rent the Forest Service cabin in the Tongass.
Correct. That's correct. That's or a transporter cannot either.
Right, and that's my understanding of how the Forest Service operates also. And then the state, Why would the state and federal issue be in here? Isn't this not trying to address private land?
basically on our statutes, although the federal government never followed it, starting in 1990. The reality was, under our laws as a state, if somebody, and they were renting those, whether it be $25 a day or $30, if they were renting it to somebody out of Sitka who flew over to one of the places that had, you know, White Sulphur Springs or something, and used that cabin to go deer hunting out of, they were supposed to be a transporter. And we've decided, you know, obviously, that that isn't going to work. And we never did enforce that either. Nor, interesting enough, did public safety enforce that either. They only enforced it on Mr. Metzger.
Yeah, there's some.
And then, is the definition of state use here broad enough to include municipalities?
Correct.
On municipal lands?
Actually, on municipalities and so forth, that is out of the field. So it doesn't count anyway on the definition of field.
So it's not applicable here at all?
No. Definition of field takes care of it.
Okay. Right. And just Senator Green, you remembered your question.
I remember
please,
my question.
Before you forget it.
Yeah, I just want to know if Senator Wagner can take friends to his duck shack.
Or just tell us where it is.
Future generations.
And can they shoot from there, even if they don't bring the food and drink?
Well, as far as
or even if they do.
As far as I know, they can, yeah.
But you yes. wouldn't allow
but
them.
I'm
that's not,
But I am not, but I am not receiving a monetary amount from them for any purpose. I'm not in the business of renting cabins or guiding or anything. But yeah.
Even in kind, huh?
So
how far do we want to stretch ethics?
Oh, hey, I think it's gone too far as it is.
But they can take a sauna in my cabin.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, just Senator Wilkowski has a question, but before we do that, just a follow up for just kind of talk us through it. If Mr. Metzger's cabin, let's assume it's by a lake for a moment. Transporter flies in there on 185, drops off Gary Stevens, Senator Gary Stevens, chasing the elusive brown bear. He
are being chased by the elusive brown bear.
This provision would have to apply for him to be able to do that, since a transporter is bringing him in. Is that accurate?
No, sir. If Mr. Senator Stevens drew a brown bear permit on Kodiak and flew into a cabin on the lake,
okay,
whether it be on private or other lands, and he was not compensating under the definition of compensation, which is more than in kind. No.
He paid an operator, a transporter, to fly the 185 in.
Okay. If the transporter was a point-to-point rate, this gets complicated.
If
a transporter is a point-to-point rate,
okay,
no one would be required to have a hat. If that transporter fee is, he's taking them there because of his personal knowledge of the conditions and of the area and of the hunting, then at that point, and he is selling that hunt more than just a point-to-point rate. Let's, for instance, the normal point-to-point rate would be $450, but instead he's charging $3,500 for that service to say, Mr. Stevens, this is the best place to take you. Okay. Then the transporter would have to be, or the person transporting would then fall under the transporter category. If he is not paying, if it belongs to a friend of his, belongs to Senator Wagner, then Senator Wagner says, go ahead and use my cabin. There's nothing there either. But if it's a person who's advertising and getting compensated for the use of that cabin, like Mr. Metzger is doing, mm-hmm, we're trying to legitimize his situation. But on a situation where it's on you flying out to my place and doing it, I've got a guide's license. At this point, I guess I would be exempt. Probably would, to keep myself clean, I'd get a transporter license, but because mm-hmm, I would probably do other things as well.
But if there was an assistant guide sitting that 185 that got off at the lake, stayed in the cabin with Senator Stevens to go chase a brown bear, what would then the provision be?
Well, the assistant guide, if he was operating without a registered guide or a master guide, there's going to be some complications because he's...
Let's assume they're all three present there.
All three present there.
Right.
Then, obviously, Mr. Stevens is paying. The registered guide has a contract that we provided for in the last requirement. Has a contract with that registered guide that's been signed and sealed by both, and he's good to go.
but...
But the transport...
The provision in this bill would be required for that to be legal, is that...
No, it'd be legal now. It's this bill, what it does is, Mr. Metzger was legal to do what he was doing, but he had to get a transporter license. All this is saying now is he doesn't have to get a transporter license.
Okay, but assuming he doesn't have a transporter license, then, okay, understand. Yeah, Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you. I want to go back to the state or federal land provision. And I know in South Central, it's virtually impossible to get a cabin. You've got to book it 5-6 months in advance.
Right.
Are we going to be running into a situation potentially under this where big game hunters are going to be renting out state cabins months in advance?
Okay. No. They would be now if DNR would allow them, and DNR does not allow that.
State DNR doesn't?
No.
Okay.
No,
so
those cabins are for public use, not commercial.
Okay. So just so we're clear, by changing this provision in here, we're not changing other laws?
No.
That's not the intent at all,
no.
Too?
Okay. It just makes sure the DNR doesn't have to become a transporter.
Okay, are there other questions or comments while we have Mr. Johnson or the bill sponsor before
move
us?
The bill.
Again?
Let's move the bill.
Very good. Is that your motion?
Beat this
let's hear your motion.
Motion.
Your motion is was what?
Move the bill with individual recommendations.
Okay, is there objections?
An accompanying common sense.
Okay.
That could be difficult.
House Bill 165 is moved with attached physical note and individual comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alice.
Quite an education, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, really.
Oh, boy.
You're right. Let's pray that common sense will prevail.
Management airborne shooting, and who's the administration representative is going to present the bill?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Doug Larson. I'm the Director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation for Fish and Game. This afternoon, we have Kevin Saxby, should be online. He will walk us through the bill, and then I'll be available along with Mr. Saxby to answer questions if you have some at the end.
Okay, very good. Mr. Saxby, you online?
There it is. Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, it's Charlie Huggins down in Juneau. We have Senate Bill 176 before us. If you will put yourself on the record, we'd be proud to hear from you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kevin Saxby, Senior Assistant Attorney General, assigned to the Board of Game since 1992. And the bill was produced to keep a commitment made to a number of interested legislators back in the Murkowski administration. They asked us to, the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Law, to work together to improve the existing intensive management law and same-day airborne law and to harmonize those laws because it was recognized that, as they're currently worded, these two laws are somewhat contradictory. It's been suggested by some that the bill is simply an attempt to influence or circumvent current litigation, and that really isn't true. The redrafting effort that has culminated in this bill predated the current litigation. Having said that, there's no question that the ongoing legal challenges to the state's intensive management program since 2003 have highlighted the weaknesses in these two statutes and how difficult it is for Alaska's game managers to follow both laws. So this is really the first comprehensive effort submitted to the legislature from the people who have to actually obey and implement these two statutory mandates to suggest ways to improve and harmonize them. If committee members, I know you're pressed for time, if you're interested in some of the legal difficulties that we've had over the years, I've got some examples I can give you, but I'll just skip that now and go to the bill itself if that's what you'd like.
Yeah, that's fine, Kevin. Please participate or continue with the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you work through it, you'll see that sections one or two, one and two, don't really make any substantive changes. They're just a conforming language in existing laws to changes that are made later in the bill. Sections 3 through 5 are where the first set of major substantive changes come in. And these are the sections that rewrite the current intensive management law. What we're doing here is we're simplifying what is currently a relatively complex and circuitous process down to its bare essentials, down to essentially 3 steps. The first step being that the board must identify the game populations that are to be managed intensively and set population and harvest objectives for those populations. Second step, that the board must then regulate to meet those objectives at all times, whether the population is below its objectives, whether it's above its objectives, or whether it's at its objectives. It's to continue to manage that population intensively, manage it for abundance. And the third step being that if the objectives are not being met, the board must take some positive action, including active management measures if those become necessary. So specifically, Section 3 sets up the obligation to identify the important deer, caribou, and moose populations that are important to manage for high levels of human consumptive use, and then requires the board to set the objectives. And this is work that's already been done under the existing law, and it's a requirement under the existing law, but it isn't necessarily the first step under the existing law. We're putting it front and center in this rewrite. And we would expect that the identifications that the board has already made over the years would be ratified if this bill is passed. Section 4 sets the requirement to manage these populations affirmatively for abundance and requires that if objectives are not being met, the board must take action, including adopting active management measures.
Mr. Saxby, stand by one. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the current law. You're deleting Section E, F, and J. And in Section E, that was just changed a couple of years ago, wasn't it?
The original versions of E, F, and J were adopted in 94 and 95, and then they were amended in, I believe, 98. Okay. So the current language you're seeing now dates to 98.
And then in the current section of the law, it talks about the Board of Game adopting regulations to provide for intensive management programs. And it sets out some scientific principles, like it specifically says consumptive use of big game prey population is a preferred use, depletion of big game prey population, a reduction of the productivity of the big game prey population has occurred and may result in a significant reduction in the allowable human harvest of the population. And enhancement of abundance or productivity of the big game prey population is feasibly achievable utilizing recognized and prudent active management techniques. Can you give me an example of when you wouldn't want to utilize those 3 scientific factors in determining whether or not to implement an intensive game program?
Well, you've oversimplified it a bit. Actually, what you've got in sections E and F are 2 separate triggers for intensive management under the existing law. The first trigger being if the population is depleted.
Okay, I understand that, Mr. Saxby, but I'm just wondering what's wrong with the current statute. The current statute lays out 3 things that the board has to look at. It's relying on science, and I'm just wondering, give me some examples of when you wouldn't rely on those scientific principles. What's wrong with the current scientific principles that we have?
First of all, they're not scientific principles. Science is only one of the criteria under F. We've also got whether it would be detrimental to subsistence uses, and we've got.
Right, and you're taking all that out.
But when you read those, you need to understand that this mandates intensive management unless those 3 criteria are met. One of those 3 criteria are met. Those aren't standards to be met to allow intensive management. Those are currently standards. The only the only grounds under which you can avoid intensive management.
Okay, but I'm just wondering, when you're looking at identify, under the current statute, when is a time when you wouldn't want to determine one of these three factors? I mean, why wouldn't you want to have a program that's physically achievable, utilizing recognized and prudent active management techniques? I mean, why would you want to get rid of that provision?
What we don't want is a checklist. Every time you create a checklist, you create an opportunity for people to argue that you haven't jumped through the proper hoops.
Okay, and you said...
What the simplification does is simply say that the board has to take whatever action it deems appropriate. And there is no scientific standard in the existing law. It's just a checklist.
Okay, can you give me an example of when you would not want to have a feasibly achievable utilizing recognized and prudent active management techniques? Can you give me an example of when you wouldn't want feasibly achievable
management techniques?
Can you answer that question for me?
I can, but you're not quite reading it right.
No, I'm reading it exactly from the statute.
The statute says that we are required to adopt intensive management unless it's not scientifically achievable.
Okay.
It's often very difficult to prove that something is not scientifically achievable. It's very, very difficult, in fact, in most of the situations we're facing now. So what that leaves us with is we are obligated to adopt intensive management in virtually every situation. We're making it less obligatory on the board through the language in the bill. We're actually reducing that standard. But we're not reducing a scientific standard, because the scientific standard doesn't say you may do it if it's scientifically achievable. It says you must do it unless it's not scientifically achievable.
Okay, if I could, Mr. Chair, let me rephrase it a different way. Section 3 deletes from the intensive management statute the provision that intensive management programs apply only to depleted moose and caribou populations or those with low productivity. Why would you want to apply intensive management programs like predator control to populations that are not depleted or those with high productivity?
Because if it's a population that's important to manage for high levels of human harvest, it's always important to do so. A good example being Unit 20A moose right now. Unit 20A moose are not depleted. In fact, they're over their objectives. It's necessary to reduce the level of the population in order to maintain it within its productive level, in order to avoid overgrazing the range. So even though it isn't depleted, it's still important to manage it intensively or actively.
Just another question. Mm-hmm. So Section 3 also deletes the provision that intensive management programs must be feasibly achievable utilizing recognized and prudent active management techniques. Why is that important to take that out?
We're not removing any, all we're doing is simplifying it down to its bare essentials. And that's only one of the two triggers. The trigger, if it's depleted, is what you have in Section E. In Section F, you have another complete trigger. And that is if the board acts to significantly reduce the taking of the species, then the board is also obligated to undertake intensive management. And there is no requirement in that case that it be scientifically achievable. So we're meshing the two into a single trigger, the single trigger being if objectives aren't being met, then the board has to take action.
And then I think just one more question, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Would it be possible under the current, under your changes, that there would be an imprudent active management technique? In other words, current law requires that it be feasibly achievable and utilizing recognized and prudent active management techniques. Would it be possible under current law, or would it be a violation of law if we pass this to have feasibly achievable utilizing unrecognized or imprudent active management techniques? Would that be a violation of the law?
I
I don't think so.
So it would be you. We would be giving unfettered discretion to the Board of Game to do imprudent active management techniques if we pass this law.
I don't think the board has ever used its discretion to adopt an imprudent management technique.
Well, but we're giving them unfettered discretion now under this law.
You're giving them, there's no question that under this law you're giving the board more discretion, but it isn't in the area that you're positing. The area that they're getting more discretion is to take a broader approach to active management rather than simply being forced into intensive management every time they reduce a season or a bag limit. Now they won't be forced into it. Now they'll be able to look at a broader range of activities. That's the whole underlying intent here.
Well, actually, as I read this, they'll be able to do anything they want, even if it's not scientifically based. Is that correct?
But your assumption is that this is the only authority for intensive management. What you need to understand is that the board, before the intensive management law was ever adopted, the board already had all the authority it ever needed to do intensive management. The intensive management law was adopted to require the board to do intensive management in specific instances because the thinking was by the legislature at the time that the board wasn't active enough. All we're doing is making it a little bit more sensible now. We're changing the underlying broad authority the board has to conduct intensive management in any situation where it thinks it's warranted. We're just changing the standards for when the board is absolutely obligated to adopt intensive management.
I'll move on if anyone else has other questions,
Chair.
Mr. Chair, for now.
Senator Green.
Yeah, I was just wondering if maybe one of the things that we're kind of overlooking here is the broad authority, responsibility, and description of the Board of Game and what they are charged to do overall. And you would not repeat that you will act sensibly, reasonably, prudent, good management, good biological material in each and every chapter. That's the overriding principle of what they do, and hence why they're reviewed, interviewed, voted upon, and then can be removed.
Right. Yeah, good Thank point. You. Excellent point. Excellent point. Okay, Mr. Saxby, please continue.
And just to add to that, I guess I'd say that the board does a number of very controversial things and is required to do so, like adopt Tier 2 hunts when there's not a sufficient harvestable surplus to provide for all subsistence uses. And under none of those other statutes do you have a checklist like you have under the intensive management law. Apparently the legislature trusts the board to make very controversial decisions in other situations about this.
Yeah, Mr. Saxby, stand by. Senator Green has a question.
Yeah, Kevin, on page 2 under section 4, line 21, or 20, if an identified moose, caribou, or deer population is not meeting the established objectives, the board shall adopt regulations. Is the regulation adoption in that case delayed until after the occasion or the disaster occurs so that you can tailor it to that particular hunt area, or kind of tailor it for that particular crisis versus a statewide policy on identifying low objectives on meeting the guidelines and population figures?
Through the chair, that's yes. Each set of regulations will be tailored because, as you remember, the very first step is to identify the specific populations that this law requiring intensive management should apply to.
Okay.
And that's only a subset of moose, deer, and caribou populations. The board's only identified roughly half of the moose, deer, and caribou populations in the state as being within the ambit of this law, being important to manage for high levels of use. So then you look at each one of those populations, you set your objectives for it, and if you're not meeting the objectives, if you're either over or below the objectives, under this bill, you would be required to take steps to meet the objectives. Okay. And like we said, for the first time, we're applying the mandate throughout the lifespan of or the life cycle of the herd in question. In other words, it isn't just when it's depleted that you act.
to meet your objectives. It's also when it's overpopulated that you have to meet your objectives. If it's important to manage it for high levels of human use, it's always important to manage it for high levels of human use.
Senator Wilkask has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Looking on to Section F, which you're deleting, requires that, says this subsection does not apply if the board determines that intensive management would be ineffective based on scientific information, inappropriate due to land ownership patterns, or against the best interests of subsistence uses. And you're taking all that out. And so you're giving, aren't you giving the Board of Game, again, unfettered discretion to create an intensive management program that is ineffective based on scientific information, or inappropriate, or against the best interests of subsistence uses?
What we're giving the board is the discretion to find that it isn't appropriate for more than those three listed reasons. Remember, the intensive management law requires intensive management unless one of those three conditions is met. With us taking those conditions out, the board is required to do something, but it isn't necessarily required to, for example, adopt a wolf control program unless it can find that one of those three conditions is met. Instead, it can find, it has more discretion to decide when or what action is appropriate, because it isn't limited to only three reasons to avoid intensive management.
But, okay, Mr. Chair, I guess if I could follow
okay.
up on that.
Yeah, please.
The Constitution requires that wildlife be maintained on a sustained yield principle. And in the statute, this gives the legislature some, you know, the legislature is the one who has the constitutional obligation to oversee the management of our wildlife. We're ultimately the ones who are responsible for upholding the Constitution. And we're turning all of that responsibility over to a board, and we're saying, go ahead and do whatever you want. Doesn't have to be based on science. Doesn't have to be based on the best interests of subsistence uses. Doesn't have to be based on, it can be based on inappropriate use of land ownership patterns. We're setting forth some principles here in the statute, and what concerns me about this is a drastic change where we're going away from scientific principles and giving the board unfettered discretion. Is there any other board or agency in the state that has this kind of discretion to basically do whatever it wants? No accountability.
The board already has exactly the discretion you're talking about. The intensive management law does not limit the board's ability to conduct intensive management. It only limits the occasions when the board is required to do intensive management. The board has authority under its general authorities to adopt laws that involve include predator control, for example. If you look under AS 1605-255, the earlier portions, then before you get to sections E, F, G, and J. The board has very broad authority, and it always has. And the Board of Fish, by the way, has very similar, what you're saying, unfettered discretion. It isn't completely unfettered, but similar broad authorities. The intensive management law is not a grant of authority, and this bill is not a grant of authority. That authority exists elsewhere in the statutes. The underlying assumption of this bill is that the legislature still intends to require the board in certain circumstances to adopt intensive management programs. That being the case, we're trying to make that meet that requirement and make it a more defensible requirement. This is not an additional grant of authority.
Okay, please continue, Mr. Saxby.
Mr. Chairman. Section 5 takes the definitions, the current definitions, and reduces them down to just two. It eliminates most of the other problematic ones. There was a very problematic harvestable surplus definition, a problematic sustained yield definition, both of which were contradictory with either current governing principles of game management, or in one case with existing case law. And we're changing the term intensive management to active management, because active management is generally viewed by game managers as a broader term encompassing more than simply predator control or habitat manipulation. And if you look at the current definition, you'll see that intensive management is defined as active management anyway, so we're just cutting out the middle term there. And then we're retaining, in its essence, the definition of providing for a high level of human harvest. There are very minor changes made to that. Because that is the core of the current statutory mandate from the legislature to conduct intensive management. Then sections 6 and 7 are also merely just conforming changes. There's nothing really substantive there. But when we get to sections 8 through 10, we get to the substantive changes again, and this time these are to the same-day airborne law.
Okay, Mr. Saxby, stand by. Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah. Going back to Section 4, is the board going to be required to make written findings justifying its decisions that it considers advisable?
When the board adopts a predator control implementation plan, it does adopt written findings. But when it, for example, when it, I'm not sure which part you're talking about, but if the board sets objectives, for example, under Section 3, those go into regulation, so those are also in writing. Mm-hmm.
And
when the board identifies populations, those go into regulation, so those are in writing.
And will it be required to base those findings in Section 3 and Section 4 on science?
The determinations?
Yes.
It'll be required to base those on the total record before it, just like it does every other decision. And every time the board has a proposal before it, the department presents the best available data and the best available science that it has. Members of the public testify, opposition groups testify, interest groups testify, and the board is required to consider all of that information under the Administrative Procedures Act and then make a reasoned decision based on all of the information before it. So that requirement won't change.
Okay. So they will be required to use science.
They'll be required to use whatever information comes to them, to consider all of the information that comes to them.
Okay, and then in Section 5, if I could, Mr. Chair, you're defining providing for a high level of human harvest, you're defining it by hunter demand. Does that include hunter demand from outside hunters or just Alaskan hunters or both?
It includes all hunter demand, and if you'll compare it to the existing law, that's almost word for word what's required under existing law.
And so, just to give an example, that you got the Nelchina caribou herd, you get 12,000 requests, you only allow 5,000. Obviously, there's more demand than supply. Does that mean you go in there and you eradicate all predators?
No, because carrying capacity and a great many other factors matter as well. You'll notice you have to set both population and harvest objectives. And the definition just lists the factors that the board needs to consider when it's doing that. It doesn't mean that hunter demand is the only controlling factor. The biological capabilities of the herd are part of it as well, and of the habitat for the herd. But certainly, historic hunter demand is an important thing for the board to consider when it sets its objective.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have 8 people online that want to testify. We'd like to get their testimony in today, so let's keep that in mind. Please, Mr. Saxby, continue.
Mr. Chairman, I'll go really quickly. I'm sorry I'm taking so long. The first changes in Section 8 take the existing same-day airborne law and for the first time mesh it with the intensive management law. As currently worded and as historically worded, they've been at cross purposes. The first change is to add brown bears to the class of protected animals. There is, in current law, there's no prohibition against hunting brown bear on the same day airborne. We're adding them to that prohibition because our feeling is that they're animals that are, they're slow breeders, they're a top keystone predator species, they're every bit as deserving of it. That protection as wolverines are. And then we're also adding wolverines and brown bears into the exception if it's necessary. I guess our thinking has been that the essence of the same-day airborne law has always been a general prohibition on same-day airborne hunting, coupled with an exception for predator control when necessary.
And the standards have varied over the years, depending on the citizen enactments and the legislative changes that have been made. But there's always been that key underlying two principles, a general prohibition and an exception for when it's necessary. We're changing the exception for when it's necessary here to mesh with the intensive management law, so that if the board determines that its objectives aren't being met, and that active management is necessary and that predator control will be conducive to achieving those objectives, that it may then adopt a predator control program. Or the other exception is if it's conducive to the health of a predator population, for example, the lice infestations on Kenai Peninsula Moose.
Mr. Chair.
In section 9.
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah, Mr. Saxby, are you saying that under current law, with this change, you're going to be protecting brown bears? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
For the first time.
Can you aerial shoot brown bears now under current law?
You can't, because there's a regulation that says you can't, but there is no statute that says you can't.
Okay.
And we're putting a statute in that says you can't.
So you can't aerial shoot wolves now. Under this law, will you be able to aerial shoot brown bears?
Only in the case of a predator control program.
Okay. So let's just be realistic with the public who are listening. You're not protecting brown bears with this. You're putting it in a statute that they're protected, and then in another section you're saying you can go out and aerial shoot them. But let's be upfront with the public about what we're doing here.
Senator, I beg to differ. There is currently no statutory prohibition against taking brown bears from the air for any reason.
There's regulations against it, and you're overriding those regulations with a statute, and then in another section you can say you can go out and shoot them. That's not protecting brown bears, Mr. Saxby.
The regulations
with all due respect,
currently allow brown bears to be taken from the air in a predator control program. So the general prohibition is in regulation, and the exception is in regulation.
Please continue, Mr. Saxby.
Mr. Chairman. Section 9 adds another exception. It says that the general prohibition doesn't apply to an employee of the department who's authorized under powers and duties in AS 160550 to take wolverines or brown bears. This is, some of these powers include things like taking nuisance wildlife, or taking wildlife to protect public safety. Currently, under existing law, and a department employee that flew out to a remote location and shot a wolf on the same day they'd been in an airplane would be committing a misdemeanor. And this puts that needed exception back in where it should be. Finally, Section 10 says that shooting does not include the administration of tranquilizers or other drugs intended to be non-lethal. There's been questions over the years, you know, just what the prohibition against shooting entails, and we're just making it clear to everybody that it doesn't entail dark guns. The remaining sections are transition dates and things like that. So I've gotten you through all the substantive changes, I think.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Saxby. We're now going to go online to Anchorage. We have Mr. Wade Willis signed up. Mr. Willis, are you there?
Yes,
and in the interest of time, we're going to limit testimony to 2 moments, 2 minutes,
moment?
2 minutes.
Okay.
So we can get through the people that have signed up. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you. I've sent in my testimony, so you can read my biography and where I live and everything. And I'll jump right into it. So I've only got 2 minutes. I'm amazed with the Department of Law's contention that this is going to help the fish and game, or the Board of Game, not institute control problems or programs. That's just a stunning twist and an obvious smokescreen. Meshing the regulations into a single trigger reduces management to the opinion of the Board of Game. They want it to be only the opinion of the Board of Game mandated by the legislature, that you're telling them that only your opinion is all that you need to verify that you need predator control. You don't need to prove by science that it's needed. You don't need to prove by science that it's necessary or effective. So you can have forage problems out there. The Board of Game goes, oh, we don't have any science, we don't need it. In our opinion, we need to kill wolves, and boom, they go out and kill wolves. Or bears for the first time. The Department of Law would tell you right now that they've been able to aerial gun bears in the past is amazing. There's no way. That has never been in the law. It has never been available to the Board of Game. This is the most highly contentious issue in Alaska. Three times we're going to vote on this. 57,000 people signed the last initiative to put this to vote. And you're going to give unfettered access to this highly contentious issue to the Board of Game? The Board of Game, who represents 15% of the Alaska residents, 85% of the Alaska residents do not hunt. There is not one representative on the Board of Game for the 85% of people who do not hunt. You're giving unfettered access to this contentious issue to a special interest group, the hunters. You cannot protect the wildlife of this state. You cannot manage the wildlife of this state in that way. The third time, there has never been a public issue in this state that has made more people become enrolled in the political process. You guys have got to take a look at this. This is not a simplification of the regulations. This is a removal of the regulations.
Mr. Willis, can you sum up your testimony?
I sure can. And, this bill attempts to remove all the essential elements of the public's, the courts, and the scientific community's ability to require that intensive management techniques, especially aerial predator control, are carefully regulated and supported by peer-reviewed scientific data, and most importantly, the public. Please vote no on SB 176.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Willis. Questions or comments, Mr. Willis? Okay, next. hey, Vic, I'm not going to say your last name. I won't murder it. I'll let you put yourself on the record.
Yes. My name is Vic Van Valenberg. I live in Anchorage, and I'm a wildlife biologist, and I am a former Board of Game member. I served on the board three different times between 1985 and 2002. Mr. Chairman, I strongly disagree with the notion that Senate Bill 176 is an improvement to the current statute, the Intensive Management Statute and the Same-Day Airborne Hunting Statute. You have gone through the guidelines that would be deleted by Senate Bill 176, guidelines to the board that were placed in the existing statutes by previous legislatures after a great deal of consideration and deliberation and input from the Department of Fish and Game and interested parties in the Department of Law. And now, in one fell swoop, this bill proposes to delete those guidelines from the legislation. Those guidelines have been characterized as a checklist that guides the board in adopting intensive management programs. And my suggestion is that if we're going to get into the existing statutes and amend them, that we add to the checklist, not delete it or subtract from it, all of the provisions that would be deleted that relate to IM programs only applying to depleted populations or those that have reduced productivity, and on down the line. They are all important guidelines that the board has followed since 1994. And it's not as if the board has been restrained in adopting intensive management programs by those guidelines. We currently have five active control programs that cover a pretty large proportion of the state. And they are acting to reduce bears and wolves and increase numbers of prey. The most objectionable thing that I find in SB 176 is the provision in Section 8 that modifies the Airborne Shooting Act such that information from the Department of Fish and Game would no longer be required for the board to find that predation is an important cause of the problems and that reducing predation would help solve the problems. I strongly urge the committee to amend 176 to restore that language. That's important language. Of course, we would want to document that predation was causing the problems,
Mr. Van Ballenberg, could you please sum up?
Yes, sir, I can. Of course, we would want to document that reducing predation would solve the problem. And so I strongly urge the committee to amend the bill to include those provisions and to not strike them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you. And next we will go to Ms. Andrea Veach.
My name is Andrea Veach. I'm an employee with the State of Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and I work as a secretary. My testimony has nothing to do with employment. Okay, as you know, Alaskans have twice voted in 1996 and 2000 against the airborne shooting of wolves by the public. Both times, putting this issue on the ballot required the labor-intensive gathering of thousands of signatures. By the clarity of the voters on this issue, the state legislature and Board of Game have disregarded Alaskan voters cast as the trophy hunter, Governor Murkowski, and now Governor Palin. Governor Palin's position on this subject does not give much credence for her frequently stated wish to represent the will of Alaskans and respect their input. Native subsistence hunters did not traditionally depend on airborne elimination of their competition to gain an advantage. Why is that necessary now? I suggest if anything has changed, is that there are more hunters expecting a bounty a cold, harsh land cannot naturally provide. Historically, the predator most dangerous to the environment and the balance of nature is not wolves and bears, it is man. Management is needed, but it's man that needs to be managed, not the wolves and bears. The human population is now 6.5 billion and projected to be 9.3 billion by 2050. Wolves and bears around the world can be counted in the thousands. These numbers alone should tell the story of what species needs to have its population control. Where will the wolves, bears, and other wildlife go when the human population reaches 9.3 billion? This is our challenge. That should be our priority. This is what the Board of Game and the Alaskan legislature are thoroughly ignoring, along with Alaskan voters. Because of our overwhelming numbers, we need to accommodate other species if we want to have any company on this planet. The short-sighted idea that every other animal should provide for humans at their expense is not only dangerous to other species, in the long run it's dangerous to us humans. We are part of a much larger whole. Most of the world has decimated its own populations of wildlife. Can we not see that the time has come to accommodate wildlife? We humans can adapt. For the most part, wildlife cannot. As their name suggests, Board of Game views animals as solely something to be killed for human consumption. Many Alaskans, and certainly many people from outside and other countries, do not view animals as just something to kill and consume. We need a broader view, such as the Board of Wildlife, to mitigate the single narrow view of use of other species. This last summer, I made my first trip to Denali Park. The most rewarding part of the trip was not seeing the animals. It was seeing the human visitors from all over the world piled into buses and so humbly and undemandingly appreciating the smallest opportunity to see the animals.
Ms. Veach, could you sum up your testimony, please? Ms. Veach.
Out there living out their lives comparatively under
Ms. Veach.
Whether they saw them or not.
Ms. Veach.
I applied.
Ms. Veach, it's Charlie Huggins here in Juneau. Could you sum up your testimony, please?
Okay. As untidy and as politically incorrect as this may be, I believe urban hunters, mostly white men, want what they consider to be their share of the moose pie. Well, I don't believe there's enough to go around for the predator wildlife, for the subsistence hunters, for the urban hunters, and for all the outside hunters. I'd rather see moose farming to ensure a plentiful supply of moose rather than see our wildlife killed off to placate urban and outside hunters. Instead of being called active game management, SB 176 could be called managing our wildlife to appease urban and outside hunters. That's what it's all about. There isn't even a pretense of using.
Okay, Ms. Veach, you have 10 seconds.
Okay. I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you very much. Questions or comments from Ms. Veach? Next, Mr. Paul Joslin, Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Resources Committee, my name is Paul Joslin, a retired wildlife biologist and a resident of Anchorage. I strongly oppose the suggested changes to SB 176. It would make legal for the Board of Game to conduct airborne or same-day airborne shooting of wolves or wolverines or brown bears on a whim. No longer would it be required to do so only after it had been provided with information from the Department of Fish and Game. No longer would it be required to authorize predator control as part of a game management plan. No longer would department employees be required to to adhere to a game management plan before engaging in airborne or same-day airborne predator control. Airborne and same-day airborne shooting of predators is highly controversial, as we all know. Common sense would suggest that it would be wise to be sure that you have a solid case before you advance things. With the new changes in SB 76, it would do just the opposite. Under the revised law, the Board of Game would engage in predator control with only the flimsiest of justification. The key words in the revision are, and I quote, conducive to achieving the objectives. If you look up conducive in the Webster Dictionary, it says tending to promote. Certainty or even reasonable certainty is not a requirement. Should the Board of Game have a mere hunch, as it often does, that predators are bad anywhere, under this revision, that would constitute sufficient evidence to engage in aerial killing programs. In summary, Kevin Saxby is absolutely right, as he said today, that under the law, you are giving the board more discretion. I thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Joslin. Questions or comments from Mr. Joslin? Okay, thank you. Next, we will go to Val Glustinchenko.
Val Glustinchenko. Thank you very much. I'm a biologist, currently working for one of the federal agencies here in town, and I'm speaking on my own time. I would like to back up the other preceding discussions from our testimonials here today with respect to the fact that the changes proposed are in fact not a simplification. They are not housekeeping items. They are making drastic changes in the intent of the previous legislation, which aims for balance in wildlife predator control and wildlife management. The proposed legislation would open the door, as we have heard, to greatly increase killing of wolves, bears, and wolverines statewide, again, as we've heard, without necessity or requirement to consider scientific rationale behind such action. Even going further, it would eliminate analysis or review from the Alaska Department of Board of Game for such increased predator control. This is outside the pale of any accepted, credible wildlife management in the books anywhere. It's going way outside, and I know Alaskans like to be unique, but this, folks, is taking it over the edge. And I'd like to point out that the Wildlife Society National Group met here, I'll make this fast, met here fairly recently within the last year and a half, and there were several presentations strongly critical of the Board of Game and their management plans and programs. Prior to that, the American Society of Entomologists unanimously created a proclamation addressing it to the governor, asking him to consider scientific and credible predator control and wildlife management. That letter was never answered. So I'd like to wind up by saying that the proposed legislation is not scientifically defensible. It's going to undermine balanced management of the wildlife, precious wildlife belonging to all Alaskans. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Val. Questions or comments for Val? Seeing none, next we'll go to Mr. Jerry McCutcheon. Oh, Ms. McCutcheon, can you hear me?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jerry McCutcheon. Chairman Huggins, I've watched this whole stuff for 60 years. I'm glad of all hearing from all the learned biologists. Gone are the days of Elmer Brown and Archdeacon and Stuck when great herds of caribou and bands of sheep roamed the foothills of Mount McKinley. Bands of sheep so numerous and thick that they could not move out of the way of oncoming dog teams of the miners, trappers, and post office dog team mail drivers. Sheep immediately in front of the dogs would just jump up on the backs of other sheep and fold back in as the dog teams passed. Imagine a dog team totally surrounded by sheep, moving through sheep, with sheep immediately in front of the dogs, jumping up on the backs of the other sheep to get out of the way, then closing in behind as the dogs moved through the sheep. It was a spectacular sight, but I never got to see it, nor will anyone else. Carl Lotzfeld, who was male dog team driver and later a miner, every time we met in a bar after Democratic election, would insist in telling me the trail on which the dog races were held was not the real Iditarod Trail. The real Iditarod Trail went through McKinley Park. The Park Service took man out of the hunting and trapping equation, and wolves slowly destroyed the coast's great bands of sheep. herds of caribou to the point there was little or nothing left. The wolves then resorted to killing each other and eating each other, or left the park for there were still game because the territory then the state practiced wolf hunting from airplanes. There were more wolves and more game when the wolves were aerially hunted. Back years ago, just before they managed to close off aerial hunting, wolf hunting, it was the wolves four and pile of snot, wrecked four airplanes, killed two people, injured two, and the wolves, no wolves were taken. I'm a firm believer in aerial wolf hunting. None of this land and crap, we shoot crap. It is just about, it is not about fair chase, it's about predator control. No wolf hunting or bear hunting by ADF&G, nor relocating bears or wolves by ADF&G. Just raise the bounty until the state has an active community of aerial hunters. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. McCutcheon. Is there anybody else in Anchorage or online that wishes to speak? Mr. Toppenberg and Soldatna?
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you. I'd like to address just one aspect of this bill, the application of any requirement that biological science be a part of the decision-making process. I'd like to point out that we, Alaska Wildlife Alliance, disagree with Mr. Saxby's interpretation and his characterizations. Clearly, this the Board of Game often gives minimal consideration to available science. Board of Game has implemented programs that cause mainstream scientists serious concern. Note that research data compiled by ADF&G is available to any interested scientist. Scientific organizations opposed to the existing programs include the National Research Council, the American Society of Mammalogists, and more recently a letter I delivered to the governor from 172 scientists from both inside and outside Alaska, making it clear they oppose these extreme programs. This bill would not only eliminate the need to consider the inadequate scientific standards that the Board of Game must now give passing consideration to, but this bill would eliminate any requirement that these that the predators are the proximate cause of the decline or possible low prey numbers. This regressive legislation should be opposed by anyone supporting modern scientific wildlife management concepts and that recognize that healthy populations of both predator and prey are necessary for healthy ecosystems here in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toppenberg. Next, we'll go to here in the room, Mr. Joel Bennett. Welcome, Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, sir.
You put yourself on the record and whom you're affiliated with.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joel Bennett. I'm from Juneau. I'm a 39-year resident. I served on the Board of Game for 12 years, actually over 12 years. I've been an active licensed hunter every year of my 39 years of residency. I've also been the organizer and sponsor of each of the initiatives in 96 and 2000, and I'm presently co-sponsoring the third ballot measure on the same subject that's been certified for a vote next August. And I have written testimony prepared, so I won't go over the points that I elaborated in that so much. But I do want to focus on what I consider to be the guts of this, and that is Section 8. Section 8 makes large-scale changes in the airborne hunting law that we have now, that we've been operating with. And I think the committee needs to recognize that. I was very surprised that Mr. Saxby didn't describe what is being taken out, what is being deleted from that statute as amended. And that's the whole key to this, in my opinion. And that, you know, essentially includes that, you know, the plan has to be based on information provided by the department. And furthermore, it also has to tie in a causal way predation either by wolves or bears with as an important reason that we're not achieving the objectives. And that is really such a vital element. I mean, if we don't actually know that wolves are causing the problem, then why would we be shooting wolves or bears, for that matter, or maybe it's habitat that's the problem, not bears or wolves. So why would we be shooting wolves or bears in that case? And that gets back to the initiative. I think what the people, and we listened to a lot of people, we got 57,000 signatures, and through all the common thread and all of that, you know, as people approached us, was we need some kind of minimal standard, some kind of minimal controls, so that the department bases its predation control, especially through airborne methods, on a bona fide problem, a serious biological problem. We attempted to define that in the initiative. It's the same language that passed in 96 by almost 60% of Alaskans. We also say that it has to be based on adequate scientific data. That's a key element. We also say that it has to be conducted by department personnel, because we think that's the most responsible, humane, and efficient way to do these programs. And we also say that it should be confined to the smallest geographical area possible. We think that's what the public really would support and go along with in terms of predator control. But this bill actually makes it more permissive. This bill actually takes that standard and modifies it to the point that there's really no standard at all. I encourage the committee to take a hard look primarily at Section 8 and what's being deleted and what's being done there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Questions or comments for Mr. Bennett? Senator Wilkie.
Not for Mr. Bennett, but maybe for the Department of Law. Is it the administration's perspective that if Section 8 or any part of this bill passes, that it will have an impact on the ballot initiative?
Through the chair, the administration's perspective is that this bill stands or fall on its own merit. Whether it has an impact on the ballot initiative would be something that the legislature could make a recommendation on, and the lieutenant governor would have to make a determination on, but this bill should stand or fall on its own merits.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Bennett. And Mr. Larson, could you come forward, please? Yeah, just a final question here for you. It's our understanding, my understanding, that the governor and the appropriate administration people support these changes as written. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is correct.
Okay, very good. Questions for Mr. Larson? Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Does the constitutional provision on sustained yield apply to predators?
Through the chair, Mr. Wilkowski, yes, it does.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator Wagner?
Yeah, I'm kind of one of those inactive hunting guys. I got a room full of rifles at home and guns and everything else, but before I would vote on this bill, I got to talk to a friend of mine who sits on the board of fishing game, board of the game. But one thing I see in this bill, or I don't see in this bill, I guess I'd say, and I've been told by people, I have no reason to disbelieve this statement, black bears kill far many more young, newborn moose calves on the Kenai Peninsula than any other predator that's there. That's brown bear, wolves, and the second highest number of predators are feral dogs. So I guess the problem I got with the things that are listed in this bill, I don't think they go far enough, and I don't think they're listing some of the predators that are really to blame for a lot of the decrease in the moose population, especially in the young newborn moose on the Kenai Peninsula.
Mr. Butch, could you address the black bears?
Through the chair, Senator Wagner, the way that the law is written currently and the way that it's being proposed to be amended would allow for black bears to fall within those species that would or could be managed under predator control activities.
And I agree with you on the spring piece, and I think in areas where black bears are concentrated, they certainly are the stalking critter of young moose calves. Okay. Is there anything else you have to say on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. The only other thing is I noticed that in the existing language that the effective date says July of 2007, and it should be 2008.
Okay.
That'd be Section 14, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So I'll make a conceptual amendment on line 25 of page 5, amended for July 1, 2008. Is there objections to that? Seeing none, we're amended to 2008, July the 1st. Do I have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we send from committee Senate Bill number 176, version A, as amended with individual fiscal notes and individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
All right, and reminder to committee members, yes, to committee members, that this will go to judiciary and then to finance. Do we have an objection?
I would like to spend more time here from Fish and Game on this. I guess what I really want to hear more about is the idea that we're removing the scientific aspects of this, and whether or not that's feasible, whether or not that's advisable. We've had Department of Law testify at length. We've had witnesses testify. I'm on the next committee that will hear this, so I'll remove my objection, Mr. Chair, and take those issues up in the next committee.
Are there further objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 176 will move from committee with attached physical note and with individual comments. We're adjourned.